This week on the BOAG World Show, we continue our season on building user-centric cultures by talking to Andrew Miller from the University of Dundee about how they established a UX culture from scratch. This show is supported by sponsors Full Story and Balsamic. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me on this week's show, as always, I don't know why I say joining me like sometimes you don't.
Well, very, very occasionally I don't, but yeah, it's
normally
much
when you're on holiday somewhere.
Yeah, and I've done that, although I am actually going away again sneakily for a long weekend.
Ooh, where are you going?
Going to Spain to our friends. We, as you know from last week's show, I went to the Caribbean.
I don't care.
You don't care, no, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
But nobody cares. That's the point.
No, they do.
The whole thing was that you doing this thought for the day would shut you up and we just get straight into that and avoid all this kind of crap.
Not going to talk now.
Good. Right. Well, get on and do your thought for the day then.
No, I'm going to talk about Spain.
All right, well, in that case, I'm going to talk about my upcoming masterclass, because people are interested in that.
I am, Paul.
I'm doing a masterclass. Did you know
that? Yeah, I did know that, and I'm very interested.
You're going to have to pay for it. I don't think you're getting it for free, do you?
I'm
generous?
I was just saying it. I can't remember what it's about. It's about conning people into stuff, isn't it?
It's not. It's called Ethical Clicks. No, not Ethical Clicks. I've got the name wrong. Encouraging Clicks, an ethical guide to encouraging action without alienating users. And I'm really excited about it. It's the first time I've ever done anything like this. So it's like 5 hours worth of material recorded in 32 individual videos. That's going to go up on Teachable, and it's going to be proper. It's going to have transcripts, and it's even going to have a quiz for each video. That's how like professional like I am kind of thing.
Is the quiz to prove that you've actually read it or watched it?
Well, I don't know, but they basically say it's good to do quizzes. So I'll do a quiz. I think it's a way of it's supposed to help you remember it. And anyway, so
you can
pre-order this. This is why I bring it up, obviously, because you know it's a lot of work to produce this. Yeah. And I'm really worried I'm going to get to the end of it and no one's going to buy it. So I thought I'll start selling it now because then I get money now rather than later. But I couldn't be bothered to create a Kickstarter campaign because, you know, that's far too much effort. And also I'm going to do it whether or not it sells. I've decided. I'm committed. Partly because Balsamic, who's a sponsor on this show, is supporting me and helping me do it, which is really good. So if you want to pre-order this or just find out more about it, really, you can go to boag.world/masterclass. There you go. So we've managed to avoid talking about Marcus's holiday and actually talk about something related to web design, although admittedly it's just me selling shit at you.
People would prefer to hear about Spain, I'm sure.
I'm sure they wouldn't. What have you got for them, Marcus? What's your thought for the day? I'm very excited by this because last time I knew what you were going to do. This time I've no clue. So that's a bit of a disclaimer, basically. I'm saying to the listener, if this is shit, it's not my fault because I don't know what you're going to talk about.
Well, see, I've got quite a bit of a backlog of blog posts I've written over the last couple of years. I just went back and had a look at what I thought might be relevant or might be interesting because, of course, nobody reads my posts. So I thought, well, I'll do what you do, Paul, and rehash stuff.
The trouble is I can't even deny that. It is absolutely true.
So go on. There you go. Well, this particular, and it is kind of, they are just my thoughts. So I guess they are thoughts for the day. This one came about from when we were pitching work for a law firm, probably 3 years ago now.
Is that how long ago it was that you last wrote a blog post? Is that what we're saying?
No. I've gone back to the start, Paul.
Oh, right.
I can actually go through that. It's not totally true. I just thought this one was actually quite vaguely interesting. I nearly said quite interesting, but only vaguely. Anyway, I started looking at the competition, the people we were up against.
Yeah.
And I started looking at what they were saying about their products and that kind of thing. And I thought, it's not really true what you're saying. Because basically, they were all claiming that they didn't lock their clients in at all. And basically, you know, all of their, you know, all of their software was open source and that kind of thing. And it just got me thinking. And it also, so back to the start of the thinking was the fact that Headscape, way back in the mists of time, we developed our own proprietary content management system, which I'm sure you can remember, Paul.
I do.
And at the time, back in the early noughties, most of the content management systems were a ridiculously expensive, six figures for a CMS, and really, really hard to use. So they were crap, basically. Mm-hmm. And we decided, took it on ourselves, that we could develop our own little CMS that would be really easy to use, and we would just bung in with the development of websites. And it was great, basically. Everyone loved it.
Mm-hmm.
But there were certain things about it, or certain things that didn't work as well as we'd like them to, or there was new features that we wanted to add to it, and the way it had originally been built meant we had to basically start again.
Yeah.
So we started again, and we did another version of it, and it was a little bit more complicated, but people still kind of loved it and continued to use it. Then, as quite a lot of this, obviously, Paul, you're going to remember, but we had a client called Nats. Mm-hmm. We still have a client called Nats. We still work with them on various projects. And way back in 2010, I'm not even going to try and pronounce it, but the Icelandic volcano with the very, very silly name blew its top and covered most of the Northern Hemisphere in clouds of dust, basically, if you remember. NATS stands for National Air Traffic Services, and the traffic to their site went from basically virtually nothing to everybody in the Northern Hemisphere in the space of about a day. And our poor little CMS couldn't handle it and fell over and never got back up again. And to be fair, virtually any content management system would have behaved in exactly the same way. Long story short, it made us look at our little CMS in a very different way. And it made me start thinking about some of the promises I'd been making to clients at the time along the lines of, oh, well, you know, it's built in .NET, as this particular system was. So, you know, any other agency that works with .NET would be able to pick it up, which is not a lie. They could do, but I started to realize that they probably never would, because it would mean them learning loads of stuff. And this, all these thoughts basically made us start looking at open source software, and we ended up going for Drupal. I'm not going to go into why we did that. We also did WordPress development as well, but it's this idea. It's basically this idea of becoming part of a community that is massive. Even if you're open source, but nobody else is part of your community, then you may as well be proprietary. And that's the kind of thing that it took me a while to kind of get to the bottom of. And I thought, that's it. What clients are interested in is business continuity. They want to know that if you all get run over by a bus, they can go to somebody else. There's bound to be a little bit of upheaval, but they can go to somebody else, and that somebody else can then carry on looking after their whatever it is, website in our case. Mm. So it's about ensuring that kind of support, even though you might not even know where they're going to go, but that support exists. And it didn't exist for us way back then, and it didn't with these clients or these other suppliers to clients. So that's my thought for the day. Doesn't really matter if it's open source. It's just about how well supported it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of agree. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of other aspects to selecting a CMS other than whether it's open source or not open source and whether it's supported or not. But in terms of, I agree that it's about the community and it's about the business continuity, isn't it?
Mm.
Absolutely. Yep. Totally agree to that. What I don't understand is how reviewing the other law firm websites had anything to do with that story.
No, reviewing the other potential suppliers, other agencies,
who
offered stuff that they claimed was open source, which it was open source. But if you looked around, you thought, well, who else is working with this software?
I
didn't know the honest answer, but I wouldn't imagine it was many.
I wasn't paying a lot of attention.
No, I started talking and you wandered
off. I was actually searching through for the article, actually, so I could include it in the show notes. So I wasn't completely ignoring you. I was just multitasking, which, as we know, we're all great at. So that's good.
I'm particularly good. I get better at it as I get older.
I get better at everything as I get older, in my opinion. Really?
Yes. Stronger. Seeing things, all of those stuff,
and I've become more handsome as well.
Well, that's true, Paul. If your pictures are anything to go by,
well, I have had bits of me fixed, which has helped. Well, I need teeth, but there you go. Anyway, right. Well, Marcus's story was far too long, obviously, and rambling, etc. So we'll move on quickly. This is my thing, efficiency. Do you know why I'm so efficient now about getting the podcast done?
Because you've got too many other things to do.
No, because seriously, every minute of audio costs me money in transcription. That's what it is. I'm
last week's tight. 68-minute podcast might make you go a bit.
I know. It was something like $10 extra, those extra 9 minutes or whatever it was. So, yeah, move on. In fact, me just explaining that has probably cost me another dollar. Right, let's talk about our sponsors, because the sponsors give me money back, which is great. So we like that. So this bit is a profitable bit. As was obviously the massive big plug for the course at the beginning. Anyway, sorry, focus. Right, full story. So full story are supporting the rest of this season of the podcast. It would have taken the whole season, but someone snuck in with the first episode. Really love these guys. Use their product all the time. It's, in my view, the next generation of kind of analytics, really. And is simply the best analytics tool I've used personally. What I love about it, I mean, there's loads of things I love about it, but one of the things I love about it is once you've put a small piece of JavaScript on every page of your site, then there's no more manual tagging. You know, when with Google Analytics, if you want to track an event or anything like that, you have to kind of go in and manually tag any element that you want to track. You don't have that problem with FullStory. So what that means is that you can basically, once the bit of JavaScript is running on the site, you can look up any historical data up to the point where that bit of JavaScript was installed. So if you've been running the full story for, say, 6 months, and you suddenly decide you want to know what's happening with this button, you don't have to tag the button and wait a few weeks to find out what's happening. You can just look back at all the historical data from the minute it was up and running on the site, see, which makes a big difference. It also makes it much easier to set up and get running, because you've just got to copy and paste one bit of JavaScript. So it can detect every kind of event you can imagine. Clicks, swipes, scrolls, text, anything is instantly indexed and searchable. And it, what's more than that, it records all the sessions. So I'm going to talk more about why that's amazing in the coming weeks and why it's useful. It also does no sampling. So FullStory captures every single user session and every interaction in that session, which is just quite mind-blowing if you think about it. You can sign up today and get a free month of the Pro account absolutely free. No credit card required in order to do that. And if you don't want to carry on after the month of trying the Pro account, if you decide it's, maybe a bit over the top for you, you can still carry on with their free account, which gives you, like, I think it's 1,000 sessions per month, which is enough to test, one or two pages if there's a particular page you're struggling with or whatever. Or maybe if you've got a low traffic site, you run it just across the whole site. So to find out more about that, go to fullstory.com/Boag. Okay, so this season of the podcast, we're talking about building a user experience culture and everything that's involved in making that happen. Now, last week's show, we were talking to Virgin Atlantic, and you couldn't help but come away really disliking Martin quite a lot. because no, actually, he's a lovely guy. That's totally unfair. But he is in quite an envious position, right? That he works in a company which kind of gets customer experience and has got a kind of long track record of that. Today, we're going to talk to a guy called Andrew Miller, who works for the University of Dundee. Now, academia, higher education as a whole, doesn't have a kind of deep-rooted kind of history in customer experience. They don't see, you know, have never seen themselves as providing an experience to students or
having customers.
Or having customers, yeah. But of course, you know, since things have changed, certainly here in the UK, because at one time when I went to university, I didn't pay a penny. The government paid it. So as a result, they didn't see me as a customer. Of course, these days, people are paying tuition fees and stuff like that. So today's students see themselves as customers, but the institutions are catching up. So it's really interesting to talk to Andrew about his experience of making that transition. So over to Andrew. So it's great to have you on the show, Andrew. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It almost feels like deja vu, like we've already recorded half of this once.
It's funny that, isn't it?
It's strange how these things work out. So I thought a good starting point would be if maybe you'd give us a little bit of background on the history of your time at the University of Dundee, a little bit about your role, how things are changing, that kind of stuff. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what's been going on.
Okay, I've got a kind of long history with the university, so I actually did my degree here back in 1999 is when I started, which is, jinx, that's almost 20 years ago. My word. So I still feel like a young person. That's bad. So I started off as a web administrator, as the job titles were back then, and I was really just kind of keeping, you know, one website or one set of web pages, I suppose, up to date for the career service. So I stayed there for a couple of years. I then went out to some of the big colleges as their kind of senior developer. Stayed there for a couple of years. And then about 2-3 years ago, the university went through one of these big restructures. And we decided that we didn't want teams in schools anymore, teams in colleges. And we pulled everybody together. And I was given the job of heading that all up. So my official title now is Head of Web Services, which essentially just means the buck stops with me as far as web goes.
So no pressure then?
No pressure, no. It's a brilliant place to work. As I say, it kind of feels like home these days, but it's one of these kind of exciting places that I've had chances to go and work elsewhere, but, you know, kind of in commercial type areas. But the stuff that kind of universities do, you kind of feel a wee bit proud to be part of that in some small fashion. So I'm Dundee through and through.
So the last couple of years must have been fairly interesting for you to suddenly have the role of leading a team. And there's been quite a lot of you've managed to bring about quite a lot of change in that period. Tell people what you're up to at the moment. What's been going on?
Yeah, so two and a bit years ago, we pulled together all the web teams. So there's people in schools, people in IT, people in admissions, and we. Not that we didn't like each other in the past, but we didn't like each other in the past.
Yeah, fair enough.
So we kind of pulled them together all in one team. We then restructured that team because really at the start we were a team by name only. So we had to kind of restructure and figure out actually how that was going to work. So we restructured the team and then we had to start building a case for completely redoing the entire website. So we were given funding probably about July last year, big, massive investment bids to basically rip everything out and replace it, build it from the ground up. And that was kind of looking at infrastructure, that was looking at content, that was looking at design. It was basically looking at the whole piece of web. So, so yeah, it's a very big and scary project, and we've just started the next process of looking at tendering for the infrastructure side of things. Mm. So things are starting to move really quickly, really fast.
But you've already done a fair amount before even the, you know, you've looked at the infrastructure side of things. You know, you've been doing a lot of, you know, alpha builds and prototyping and all of those kinds of stuff. And I'm kind of quite interested in the journey that you've been on, because universities haven't traditionally seen themselves as even providing a service to customers. Even the idea of customers is quite alien, isn't it, to universities. And so this season of the podcast is about providing a great, building a user experience culture. And I feel like, considering the starting point that you came from, you've been able to, you know, make some pretty good inroads into that. Do you think that there is a change coming about at the University of Dundee? And, you know, do you think that though that historical lack of customer service is problematic? What's your opinion on that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think universities in the past had this viewpoint that they were kind of like ivory towers and, you know, it was almost a privilege to come to university and... I mean, Dundee, when I came to Dundee, it wasn't hugely like that, but there was still an element of you should feel privileged to be here and you take what you're given. And, you know, and even at that time, the idea of students having an idea or, wanting to push back on things they felt that weren't perhaps quite right. Well, that it didn't happen, but it wasn't as big as it is nowadays. Mm. But I think that the big changes that's been happening in the sector, certainly in terms of all the funding, we have a lot of people come to university, but the funding arrangements are changing. We've got these fees coming in. There's an opportunity for universities to make an awful lot more cash and develop an awful lot faster. And that's kind of generated this sudden look at, we actually kind of need to take this stuff seriously. Mm-hmm. And then now students are consumers. They have a choice. They have there's a lot of courses that are unique to certain institutions, but, you know, broadly speaking, there's a lot of stuff that's perhaps mirrored in different places. So you have that choice whereas in the past you perhaps didn't. And that's really starting to make universities wake up and go, jings, this world is changing round about us. We kind of need to figure all this out. And I would say from Dundee's point of view, we've actually been really lucky. So we did this big restructure, and you can see restructures as being these bad things, mm-hmm. and things that are just going to be an annoyance and it's going to throw baby out with the bathwater. But actually for Dundee, it was this fantastic time of change that just created this culture of change that we could then latch onto. So in Webb, we've been able to do stuff now that we would never have been able to do, you know, 5, 6, 10 years ago, just because that whole culture is changing round about us, people are starting to wake up to it.
So you effectively used the disruption that went on anyway with the kind of organisation-wide change to introduce some new processes and thinking? Is that what you're getting at?
Essentially, yeah. It's a time when you can just latch onto these things, and people are so busy going, oh, I don't know what's going on, or, you know, we need to find answers to this. If you can give a confident and coherent argument as to how to do it, people start to tend to kind of listen to you and go, oh, actually, maybe this is the way to do things. So yeah, we were able to kind of start to put a lot of stuff in place. We were able to push back quite strongly. The university management group gave us really strong steer as to what they wanted us to focus on, so we could actually... We had the mandate to go, right, this is what we're focusing on. And that stuff, yes, it's important, but actually, you know, in the grand scheme of things, we're going to leave that till later on. So it allowed us to prioritise much more than we'd ever done before.
Getting that clear vision of where you need to be taking things is really, really important in any organisation. The team that gave you that clear mandate, did you feed into that ideas of where you should be going, or did it primarily come from them?
it kind of primarily came from them due to the, I mean, Dundee was going through a kind of a financial crisis, I suppose, you know, much like a lot of universities. And we were having to focus on the core issues. So we had very clear direction from to say, you know, forget about the rest of the stuff. This is what we need you to focus on, and this is what we need you to make improvements on. And we actually were able to spend a long time just focusing on one or two areas that gave us larger returns on investment rather than spreading us very thinly across, you know, and just basically chasing our tails.
And that's a problem you see. So I see so many in so many different digital teams across so many sectors that trying to do too much with too little, and it inevitably causes problems. So that's where getting a kind of set of prioritized goals is so good. I mean, you're painting a very positive picture, really, of change beginning to happen. But I'm kind of quite interested in also the challenges that you faced, especially around the area of getting colleagues and stakeholders and management to think about that your digital future in terms of the user and what the user wants rather than necessarily what the organizational objective is. Have you come across any challenges in that area?
Yeah, I mean, I would have said that, well, certainly for Dundee and probably lots of places, you never set out to have a bad experience for people. And people, you know, you don't wake up on a Monday morning and go, right, you know, I've got 10 students that I'm looking at and I'm going to make their life miserable. Well, generally speaking, you don't think that.
There may be some students that's justified for, yeah.
But I think that the trouble is that we have difficulty understanding what a good experience actually is. And that for a lot of people, they've been here for so long and been doing the same thing and working in a broken way, that actually changing that mindset or you know, being able to see that actually we could make this better is just a hard thing for them to comprehend. And I think the challenge that we've had is just trying to get them to change that thinking. So, I mean, there's, you know, one example might be, you know, on our forms on our website, we're just going to ask for loads and loads and loads of information that so that we have a brilliant picture of who you are, so that when it comes to you actually asking a question, we can give you an answer straight away. And the idea of, well, actually, maybe somebody only wants to put their email address and the question in without having to fill out, you know, massive amounts of forms. You know, it's kind of up to us to kind of deal with all that stuff in the background. So it's about changing these ideas and kind of, in some ways, the way we've done that is we've kind of done it under the wire and A/B tested things and actually got in and said, look, you know, I mean, one of the examples was during the clearing process last year. So clearing for universities is a time when all students have their exam results and perhaps they've done better, perhaps they've done worse, but it's a time when they can change university or pick up, you know, university courses. And we kind of thought, well, I think we can make this process better by taking over the homepage, funneling people through. And there was a bit of resistance to it, like, you know, that's a bit unusual. We don't know quite what happens. But we went and did it anyway for English people coming from England. Yeah. So the Scottish people couldn't actually see what was going on the website. We did it for England only. And we were able to increase the conversion rate by, I think, about 60%, people getting from A to B.
Brilliant.
So I mean, using that data, people then started to go, well, actually, you know, maybe we should do something more, or maybe we should do, you know, a bit here and a bit there. But it's getting that understanding of what a good experience for the person is. And sometimes what a good experience for the user is doesn't always necessarily match to what's a good business process for people.
Yeah.
And I think some of the places are so squeezed for resource that the idea of changing something that potentially makes it harder for them or, you know, introduces any barriers is just this, no, we'll just keep it the same. We'll just do it as we've always done it, regardless of how, you know, how many more applications you could bring in, or how much easier you could make the whole process. So I think for me, that's the thing that's the hardest thing to change.
So, I mean, just picking up on that clearing example, your decision to focus to do that just for English students, was that a kind of compromise of, well, let's try it for English students. If it works for them, then we can roll it out for everybody. Is that the kind of logic?
There was a kind of business logic behind that as well. Oh, right. So it's to do with the funding model. So Scottish students are paid via the Scottish government. We don't get, so we have a kind of minimal fee that we get from them. What we call RUK or rest of UK students, we can charge the full fee for that.
Okay.
So financially, they're a very attractive option for us, or very attractive audience for us.
I see.
So that's kind of the reason why we went for that.
So how did you persuade, you know, bearing in mind that's one of your more attractive audiences, how did you persuade people to allow you? You said you've experienced some resistance in terms of taking that approach. And you said, and we just did it anyway. What did you do to persuade people that that was okay? Or did you just take an arbitrary decision?
I think that there are two things. I think you have to build up the trust of your managers, your line managers, first of all, so that when you come with these crazy ideas, they don't immediately go, they don't immediately shut you down. They're at least willing to hear you out. We then created mock-ups of what this would look like, so that you could actually physically see what would happen. We then said, right, we're not going to do all the traffic. We'll do 50% of the traffic. So 50% of people are getting what's already there. 50% are getting the new stuff, and we'll monitor it on almost a kind of hourly, maybe half day basis. So that if it does look like things are going pear shaped, we'll switch it off, and we can do that very quickly.
Love it.
So by the time you're getting that real time data coming in, and you can see the conversions either way, I was feeding back on a 2-hourly basis to people to say, look, this is what we're seeing, this is what the old site was seeing, this is what the new site was seeing. They actually went, could we increase that traffic, or could we, so they were actually getting engaged with it as well. And it was a test for us. We'd done a few A/B tests before that, kind of relatively low risk things, but just to check the methodology and just to show the results. But I think if they didn't have that trust in us to start with, that would have been a much harder sell. Now, my direct line manager, she completely gets what we're trying to do and is a big champion for us. Her line manager, he sits on the university executive, and he's also a champion for us, but is a bit more risk averse in some respects, just because of that. He has that larger responsibility to try and keep things going. So if you can try and show them the data and try and give them the impression that this is not a high risk thing, this is completely under our control, we can switch this off, we can do stuff, we can do it very, very quickly. I think there's a lot of people's mindsets are still focused on print, and that you need a 5-week lead time, and once it's printed, that's it done, and it can't be changed. Actually getting that into their heads that we are in complete control of this, and we can tweak as much as we want based on the data that's come back.
I think that's an absolutely superb case study that you've just given there about changing culture and introducing different thinking, because you prototyped a little bit there. You showed them what better could look like, which excites them. And as you were saying earlier, people have a real problem picturing that. Then you did some smaller A/B tests on other things in order to build a bit of trust and show them the process. Then, you only sent it out to a small percentage of users, and you gave them real-time feedback, both of which reduces the risk from their point of view and gives them a sense of control. I think it's just a genius move the way you did that. I think it's very, very good indeed. So is there other things that you've done that you found have helped to shift that culture and that thinking a little bit?
Yeah, one of the things we did last year, it was kind of following on from work with you, actually. We started to look at these top task sessions, And essentially, we tried to get as many people as possible, and we did pop up stalls, mm-hmm. we did booked events, we did lectures, we basically made ourselves a nuisance around campus to try and get as many people involved as possible. And we asked them a single question: what is the problem you're trying to solve? And it's quite interesting now. We're hearing that phrase coming back at us. And not necessarily in a digital web meetings, but in other thinking within the university. So the nice thing about that question, what is the problem you're trying to solve, is it focuses their minds on the problem rather than what they perceive the solution to be. So one of the problems we've had in the past is that we have lots of people thinking that they are web experts, or they're hobbyists, or whatever it is, they've had experience in the web before. And they will come up with the solutions for us. And they say, right, this is what you do. And in the past, we've just gone, right, okay, we'll implement that regardless of how we're going to do that. But this, what is the problem you're trying to solve, focuses their mind, doesn't get into the solutions. They don't need to worry about that. That's for us to worry about once we know what the problems are. So they were brilliant. We've had hundreds of people engaging with that, either through the stalls or through kind of online submissions. And that also gave us the direction of travel, or it gave us a body of evidence to say to senior management, this is the direction of travel that we think we need to go in. And that there's actually too much here to try and retrofit. We need to start again. And that gave us just more evidence for that argument. So the talk task sessions have been excellent. One of the things we've been doing this year, which has been brilliant, is design sprints.
Good. Tell us about that and how that's worked.
So these are brilliant. I think this came from the likes of Google and Lego, and a lot of the big companies are now doing them. Essentially, it's this kind of period of condensed thinking around a specific problem. So the stuff that came out of the top task, we started to see common themes, that common big problems that we kind of needed to fix. So what we did was, I think it's a five-day process normally, that you need to get people engaged for all 5 days. We thought we're never going to manage that, so we managed to condense it into 3 days, but actually the time that we need people there, just 2 days. So essentially what we've done is we've got them booked fortnightly up until Christmas on a range of subjects, and we've invited people along. So we've had academics, we've had some students, we've had people from professional services, and they all come together and we focus on a single solution. So we spend the morning looking at the problem, understanding the problem. We've done a whole pile of research up until that point, and we present that to them to say, look, this is what we see the problems being. We look at perhaps how other people are doing this, some good ideas. We then generate conversations around about that to say, is this what you see? Is this what we see? How do you think this could be better? And then in the afternoon session, we actually get them prototyping. Cool. So we do things called kind of crazy eights, which is basically a big A3 sheet folded into eight pieces, and they have 8 minutes to do eight different solutions to the problem. So it's very rough and very ready. We then put it up on the wall, and we get each person to feedback and say what their thinking was in this. And it's been a really excellent way of getting buy-in across the community, because they come in and they start to understand what our thinking is. They start to understand our methodologies. They start to understand why we're being so passionate about this. And actually, they start to feel a bit of ownership of it as well. So coming out of that, we have a prototype, and it's basically written up on a whiteboard or on a bit of paper as to some rough ideas. Our designer and UX manager then get together on the next day and they prototype a more high fidelity solution. And then on the third day, that goes out and it gets tested. So we again go and make ourselves nuisance across campus and set up a TV screen and say, this is what we're doing. What do you think of it? What's your feedback? We also have use things like Marvel that allows us to get comments, and so we send that out. And we've been trying to make it as widely available as possible. And actually, the whole web project, we've been saying, if you want to be engaged, you can be as engaged as you want. Here's all our thinking, here's all our research, here's all the data sets that we're working with. So really, there's no reason for somebody to come back to us later on and say, I didn't know about this, or I had no opportunity to engage in this. So, but the design sprints have been brilliant. And we've now been hearing, we've now got other departments coming to us and working in the design sprints so that they can understand it and then take that back to their own areas and start to
That's brilliant. When you start to see other teams going, oh, can I do what you have done? You know that you're on the right track and you're beginning to win people over. So that's hugely encouraging. And also, I like the way that you've managed to make the design sprint a little bit more practical in the real world, because like you say, getting 5 days with people in a lot of situations is pretty much impossible. So after you've done the testing, you validated the prototype, do you then take it back and show it to the people that were involved in the initial session and, tell them how it's got, how it went?
Yeah. So we send the prototypes back out to them. So they're really the first people seeing the prototypes before we take it out to the general community. So they'll feedback on us. It's interesting, we've kind of evolved the process because I think the first couple of sessions people thought, right, I'm designing the final solution. Then the prototypes come out and the prototypes have to then kind of work in the wider design governance frameworks, the brand guidelines and whatever else. And people have gone, well, this isn't quite what we agreed. So what we've had to try and emphasise is, look, this is about getting ideas. This is about generating possibilities, trying to get a direction of travel, trying to get you engaged in what we're doing so that you know how things are going to go. But broadly speaking, everybody's been quite enthused about it and trying to think about how they actually do it for their own areas.
That's good. I mean, we've talked about usability testing that you've been doing. We've talked about top task work that you've been doing. Is there other forms of research that you do to better understand user needs? I mean, in some ways, with a university, it's relatively easy because you've got, people that weren't long ago your target audience actually on site with you. So I imagine, that kind of helps, but I just was interested in your research process.
Yeah. So essentially the best way is just getting out and speaking to people and actually starting to understand their pain points and actually starting to put ourselves in their position as well and go through what they're going through. So, I mean, things like, matriculation or, when they register for their courses at the start of term. We've gone along to that and we've basically gone with a big bag of sweets. And because they have this standard big long queues while they go through this. So we just start talking to them and we start asking them about things. We start to get them to fill out kind of quick forms and iPads. We're about to start doing stuff at open days, which again will be kind of taking stuff and testing it and getting their feedback. We basically just try to go and speak to as many people as possible. As we develop pages on the current site, we also do a lot of co-writing. So this is about actually we try and go and speak to the academics and the people who are trying to sell their courses and actually develop the stuff with them as they go through it and then trying to get their target audiences for the course pages to go, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? To get that back again. Actually, on the co-writing, one of the things we found really effective is taking a microphone recorder and just get them to talk about their course. And because what we found is that they are very passionate about their course until they try to type it on a keyboard. And then the academic mentality comes in and you suddenly get this, 3,000 page treatise about, whatever else you think. That's no use to man or beast. So it's about actually what we've tried to do is not be too hard-nosed about these are our processes or our policies or whatever else, but focus more on, right, okay, that didn't work. We need to try something different. And we've really tried to promote the idea of, this might not work, but at least we're trying it. and actually allowing people to try stuff. And if it doesn't work, we'll pull it and we'll change it and we'll tweak it. And, you know, it doesn't need to be set in stone. And once you give people that freedom, they then start to relax a bit, and they then start to be more open to trying different things. But yeah, speaking to people. We've done card sorts, we've done user stories, we've recorded people on the site. A classic one was we went and tested the prospectus request form, and it said at the top, we will only post to UK addresses. And then it came to the country drop down for putting your address in, and the only country that wasn't there was UK. And it was one of these things that we went, you know, and we needed to get a body of evidence to actually change that. And eventually, we got, you know, kind of senior manager saying, "Go and request a prospectus, please." And we had people coming back. You know, we recorded their faces and their comments, and they were saying things like, "I feel stupid. I feel like it should be there," but you know. And then they were bouncing around the form. And once you actually started to take those videos back to senior management to go, right, okay, here's how your users are reacting. Suddenly they go, "Oh my word! What on earth is going on here?" And you then get the buy-in to then.
So, talking of senior management, you know, have you had any scenarios where they've kind of swooped in further down the line and basically said, "Well, I don't care what the research says, we're going to do this anyway," you know, or have they been pretty good, generally speaking?
Generally speaking, I can't applaud them highly enough for this. They've generally said, "You are the experts. This is why we're paying you. Go and do your job." In fact, we tried to set up a governance group the other week just to kind of ratify policies and procedures. And the kind of feeling was, "Are you sure you want a governance group? Could you not just make this decision yourself?" Which is fantastic. Now, the flip side of that is we kind of need a governance group so that we have the buy-in from, you know, the official sign-off and the policies and procedures that we need. But that's a great situation to be in. There are one or two. You will always get people who will disagree with you or try to push back or whatever else. Generally, what we've found best is getting those people in to work with us, showing them the data. I think the biggest kind of aha moment for me, the biggest kind of light bulb moment for me was when I kind of started to be on all these kind of more senior committees, started to see the level of information you have to deal with on a daily basis. And then went, these guys don't need a 5-page essay from me on why we need to do stuff. They just need to know the hard facts now so they can make a quick decision on it. And we've really tried to use data quite strongly to make that that case for change. I mean, very early on, I went into the senior management team and said, "Look, we have 500,000 web pages across all our domains, all our Dundee AC UK domains at the moment. If I put one person on that to look at every page just for 10 minutes to decide whether it's correct, up to date, is required, it's going to take me 53 years to get through it." And when they went, "Oh, James, we can't spend 53 years getting the website right," like, yes, this is why we need to do something fairly drastic. And then we had people putting up their hands and going, "How can we help you with this?" So I've tried as much as possible to be on their side and to understand it from their point of view, give them the information that they need, but also you need to go into these meetings confident in your own abilities. I mean, in fact, you don't need to be confident in your abilities. You just need to appear confident in your abilities. If you say anything with enough confidence, people, not that they'll believe you straight away, but they will have more peace about trusting that you know what you're doing. So that's kind of, so largely speaking, we've not had a huge amount of problems. I think having our director sitting on that senior level has helped get that voice across, and also we've kind of built up a reputation for delivering things on a regular basis and improving things and changing the way we do things. So they are seeing that, you know, they've not just spent all this money and then nothing's happening for or 12 months.
I think that is such an important thing, that people can see progress, can see change, can, you know, it makes such a difference. And also, the other thing that you said there, which I think is a really good takeaway, is that it sounds like you've put almost as much effort into understanding your stakeholders and your colleagues and management as you have into understanding your users. You know, things like you were saying, where they don't need a 5-page document. They need something very concise and to the point. And I do think taking the time to understand those people that we work alongside and whose buy-in we need is such an important part of it. So,
exactly. I mean, these guys have got the weight of the institution on their shoulders, and you see the papers they get to these meetings every week, and I feel heart sorry for them, the decisions that they're going to make. So I'm not going to make life harder for them. I'm going to try and make life as easy as possible for them to say yes, go ahead.
Absolutely.
And do it.
So one last question before we wrap up, which is, how do you see the user experience at Dundee and then broader speaking in higher education as a whole evolving over the coming years? Do you anticipate big changes in your sector and your institution?
I think so. I can't see this not becoming a big thing. I mean, the rise of things like league tables, you can argue whether league tables are a true reflection of a university and the service that it provides. But certainly in an international context, it's one of these things that's increasingly used to promote us. So I can't see things like user experience not becoming a big thing. And at Dundee, we're already seeing it, as I've said, that we're seeing people starting to talk about the user. We're seeing people turn around in meetings and saying, you know, have you spoken to a user yet?
Brilliant.
Without any prompting from us.
That's like the kind of, the nirvana, the holy grail of any user experience person is when colleagues start saying, have you spoken to users? Perfect.
Yeah. So I mean, it's brilliant. I think the danger that we have is that we have pockets of that happening. So everybody's asking users and they're getting their own little bubble of user experience. What we really need to do as a university is look at that customer journey from inquirer right through to alumni and go, right, how does everybody feed into that customer journey? And once you map those things to that customer journey, you then start to see the gaps or the problems or the bottlenecks, and you can then start to fix those things. So I think that's the next big challenge for certainly us as a university and certainly for the sector, to look at this seriously. And it not, in some ways, this focusing on a digital thing is actually hampering efforts to properly focus on user experience.
I can imagine that.
Because it's almost like when web came in, well, that's the IT guys that do that. You know, I don't need to worry about that because that's IT guys that do that. And I think we're in a slight danger of going, this is a digital thing, so it's nothing to do with admissions or student services or library or, you know, that's you guys. We need to get this seen as a whole institution thing, and do it from start to finish. And everybody has some role to play in that user experience. You would hope that it's eventually feeding into some kind of digital solution rather than anything else, but it needs to be about that customer first focus, rather than too much about the digital first, because that's somewhat hampers
absolutely
us.
Wonderful. I think that's a great note to end on. The one last thing I wanted to ask you is, I've got a vague memory that you're actually blogging this journey and sharing different things that you're doing along the way. Is there a website people can check out to follow what you're doing if they want to know more?
Yeah, so we have a team blog. So it's blog.dundee.ac.uk/web. And we're trying to use that. We're putting stuff up on a kind of weekly basis to say, this is what we're involved in. Here's the stuff coming from the design sprints. Here's the other stuff that we're involved in. Just so that we're being as open and transparent as possible. And we're getting a kind of a lot of good feedback from other institutions as well looking at that. We had St Andrews University coming to some of our design sprints as well.
Good to know.
This is one of the nice things about university sector is we all kind of collaborate on things and help each other out. So
wonderful. So, no, it's good. Okay. Well, talking of which, I will see you very soon, I imagine, at IWMW, which is one of the big conferences in higher education in July, I think it is, isn't it? Until then, thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul.
All right. So there you go. Andrew has done, in my opinion, the impossible at the University of Dundee. He really has made such a difference there. I don't know. Have you met Andrew, Marcus? Do you know him?
I have met him on at least two occasions.
Oh, there you go.
Probably more. I couldn't help notice and felt very sorry for you that you said that you had to start again with the recording.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's always that's a nightmare. Hideous. Yeah,
but it was a couple actually all right. Sorry, carry on, Paul.
Well, I was just going to say it was actually all right. Kind of, you know, we went in a slightly different direction, so that's fair enough. Sorry, you were going to say a couple of things. Go for it.
A couple of things just sort of came out of that, which I thought were interesting, and it's this kind of realization that they've got testers on tap. And it's kind of like, I'd never even thought of it like that. And it is, they can just literally walk out the door and go, what do you think of this? And it's, you know, real proper end user stuff. And it's like, so that was a bit of a revelation.
There are some limitations to that. For example, people quite quickly become institutionalized, you know.
That's true. Yeah, they stop being prospectives, don't they? But you can ask them, can you, you know, put yourself in the position of when you were researching universities. It's not like asking me.
No. And also, of course, you've got the advantage that they run regular open days where prospective students are coming along, so they can do that kind of thing. Also, I guess it's harder to, you know, because they've got multiple audiences, and some of those audiences are peers at other universities or grant enabling bodies or business, and those ones that are harder. But certainly to get prospective, you know, students is really easy, which is lovely.
And the other one was using a general restructure to kind of push through your new transformation thing. It's like, that's a good one. I mean, that's like that happens all the time in any large company, institution, organization, whatever. They're always restructuring. So I thought that was great. And finally, I love the fact that he was trying to empathize with senior management rather than moan about them. Because everybody else moans about, I never get no one listens to me, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, well, if you approach things like Andrew did, then you're more likely to get stuff done.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a very smart guy. I mean, he's had an incredible mentor supporting him and helping him through the process.
He's been on this show before anyway. He was on the show to talk about depression.
Yes, so he was when we did the lightning talks. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, quite incredible guy. Really, really impressed at what he's managed to achieve at the University of Dundee. All right, let's talk about our second sponsor, which is Balsamic, are my favourite supporter at the moment, because they seem to be helping me with everything, which is lovely. But they can help you too, dear listener. Did you notice where I transitioned so well there? That was also almost smooth.
Paul Professional Boag.
I know,
that's
right?
Your middle name.
Exactly. So Balsamic can help you with prototyping. They've been around forever. So, you know, talk to anybody who has been a digital designer for any length of time in any field, and they've probably already heard of Balsamic. I've used it a lot, but I have to confess that over time I actually stopped using it. Right, I ended up doing my prototyping in tools like Sketch combined with something like InVision or that kind of thing, which I think a lot of designers do. And that's great for designers and fine because those are tools that they know and are familiar with. But what about other people? You know, what about project managers, product managers, business owners, consultants, programmers? These are the kind of people that should also be engaged and involved in the prototyping exercise, that we should be listening to their opinions, and they've got something to say in doing it. Yet a lot of these tools are actually like a barrier that keeps them out. you know, and allows designers to keep control of it. They're the ones sitting in front of the computer in the meeting doing the prototyping. And actually what we want to, what Balsamiq want to do is make prototyping accessible to everybody. That all of these kinds of people, that, you know, a developer can do prototyping as well, that they can express their ideas visually. And it, they're very much about democratizing the design process and allowing non-designers to participate in it. Because let's be honest, non-designers can have good ideas, you know, just as much as designers can. Right? Sure, designers have got more experience. Sure, their hit rate is going to be higher, but that doesn't mean other people can't have good ideas as well. Not only that, even if all that anybody else does is express bad ideas, at least you'll be clear about what those ideas are because you can visually see them, because it's really hard to explain this stuff. And drawing it on paper, a lot of people lack confidence drawing that kind of stuff. And if they, and it's so much easier just to drag and drop stuff around. Also, with Balsamiq Cloud, you can collaborate remotely on this stuff, which makes a big difference as well. So, there you go. I really love the way Balsamiq are going, which is they're focusing on that non-designer market and trying to democratize the design process and allow anybody to take part in it. You could get a 30-day free trial, and you can get 3 months for free of using Balsamiq Cloud using the code BALSAMIQBOAG, right? So get your 30 days for free. If you then decide to sign up, you go in and enter your billing information, and there'll be an opportunity then to add in the code BALSAMIQBOAG, and that will give you the first 3 months absolutely free of charge. So you can find out more about that by going to balsamiq.cloud. All right, so that's pretty much it for this show. Marcus, back to you for your joke.
For my 15-minute joke.
Just now, this, to cost me money, yeah.
This, I ought to look up one really long one. Anyway, this is not a long one, it's a very short one. But, Paul, you're going to have to concentrate.
Oh, dear. All right. Yeah.
Otherwise, it might take you a while to get it. You might not. You might get it straight away. Anyway, it's from Paul van den Doel.
Oh, yeah.
People who can't distinguish between etymology and entomology bug me in ways I can't put into words.
I do get that, fortunately. Yeah, if you don't know those terms, then it wouldn't. It doesn't matter how much you concentrate. I suppose. You could infer it, couldn't you? Mm. I suppose. Yeah.
But I thought that was very clever, and I don't do clever.
Yeah, so that wasn't an appropriate joke for us. well, never mind.
Please send me more jokes.
Yes, and you can either send them by emailing marcus@boagworld.com or join the Slack channel, because there's a whole channel dedicated to jokes by going to boagworld.com/slacking, I think it is. All right, so that's it for this week. Thank you very much for joining us, and speak to you again soon. Bye.